is Veda Samarn, and I was the script supervisor on The Office.
Welcome, welcome, one and all, to The Office Deep Dive. It is nice to be back with you all on this fine Tuesday, or whatever day you happen to be listening. I am your host, Brian Baumgartner. Today, we're wrapping up our little mini deep dive on the women of The Office with a woman who was truly the glue of our show. She kept everything together. Our script supervisor, Veda Samarn. This is someone I respect and admire so much, okay? She was with us on set every single day, making sure that we did our jobs and set our lines, and that the director, the editor, and the writers all got what they needed to make a great show as well. And so how was she repaid? Well, she was repaid by the cast with groans, with eye rolls, because when we were having fun shooting on set, when Veda came in, well, it's because we did something wrong. Oh, that's how we repaid her. But I really do. I love her. And Veda and I, we had a special connection because Kevin's car on the show was actually Veda's car in real life. Yeah. Remember Kevin's fuzzy steering wheel cover? Now that's all Veda. Think of this. The simple task of keeping the entire cast on track, helping everyone with lines, marking every take, supporting the director, editors, actors, props, wardrobe, all at the same time. She even made sure all of the clocks and watches were set to the same time. Yeah, that was all her too. Now, when we spoke all the way back in February of 2020, she was working on Steve Carell and Greg Daniels' show, Space Force, with lots of other Office cast and crew. So she was getting to hang out with that crew almost every day in that moment. Lucky her. And, well, lucky you. Because now you get to listen to my conversation with the incomparable Veda Samarn.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
Oh my gosh! How are you?
I'm good.
So good to see you. Oh my gosh.
Unbelievable.
I know, it's been so long.
It's always so,
right there, right? Yeah, right by that mic. He'll come in.
Okay, it's always so fun to see people from The Office. It's just,
I know. Well, you were just working with a bunch of them.
Yeah, that was a really cool experience. Just be back with, you know, Steve.
Right.
A whole bunch of us.
Dave Rogers,
yeah. So it was very cool.
Yeah, so, and was that it? Wait, who is it?
Well, Greg.
Greg. Yeah. Do you still have the RAV4?
No. Oh, gosh. Okay, so, you know, I remembered a good story about that, you know, because the prop department always had to change my license plate.
Right. Oh, right, to make it Pennsylvania.
And I once drove home with the Pennsylvania plates, I remember. And when I got home, I thought, oh, my God, that's not good, is it? You know, And then of course, I didn't know how to get them off, so I had to drive back the next morning with them on. But it doesn't reflect well on the prop department, I guess.
That's good, though.
You know, but also, I remember there were all these stickers all over it that were like Pennsylvania stickers that I just left on.
Oh, you afterwards?
Well, because Kevin was always there, so my car was always
right
there. And that's another continuity thing that I thought of, you know, like the car continuity. There were so many weird kinds of continuity.
Right. All right. So first, how did you get hooked in? Was it through Ken Kwapis?
Yes.
Okay.
I had done a movie with him. I did a movie that he wrote called Sexual Life. So I knew him from that. And he knew I was smart and that, you know, I could figure stuff out. And you know, that this show was going to require someone who could figure stuff out.
Right. And you came in Diversity Day, right?
Yes, that's the second episode.
The second episode.
Yes, yes, yes. I didn't do the pilot. I never met the person who did the pilot. But no, I did every other episode after that, though. I just stuck with it.
Wow.
I mean, why wouldn't I? I mean, it's the best show to work on.
Yeah. The way the show was shot, was that more difficult for you? In other words, like, there are no marks.
Right.
So much improv happening.
Right. So that would affect you a lot, too.
Yeah.
Yes, it made my job completely different. I had to reinvent it. I think everyone did, you know, in their own job, in their own department, in their own capacity. They had to reinvent what they normally do. You had to throw it out the window and start all over again because this was really different. At the beginning, no one was allowed on set, none of the crew members. You remember that?
Right, that's right.
Because the idea was that it was going to feel like a real office. And you guys were going to get acquainted with the space and feel like you were home when you were there so that you would feel free to do whatever. So the way that affected me was humongous because, first of all, I had to be in the green room with the writer the entire, I think it was 2 or 3 seasons we did it that
way. Right.
So I was outside the main office. I was outside the door. And so between takes, we would both have to run in. I mean, literally run in to give our notes. And the no slating meant that I had to reinvent the way I did my notes because I had to be able to signal to the editors where all the good parts were. So I had to use time code instead of slates to separate out each part of it. So I had to create a new way of doing the notes. This was at the beginning. Later on, it got a little bit more traditional, a little bit more.
Right.
But at the beginning, it was totally new. You would just slate the scene, and the camera would just keep rolling. And a lot of what was on the camera was just the camera sitting on the ground and feet walking by. So they had to use my notes, literally, to find the takes and to find the coverage. Like I'd say, here, the camera's going wide now, so we're going to get a 3-shot of the accounting department.
Right.
And then, you know, in this take, we got a close-up of Kevin. In this take, we got a close-up of Angela. In this take, we got a close-up of Oscar. You know, it was like every take was a different piece of coverage or, you know, a continuity. There was so much continuity. But luckily, everyone was on top of it. So it wasn't just me, but I was definitely I needed to track so much.
Right.
Because, you know, the episodes would take place in the course of a day. So it all had to make sense.
Right, right, yeah. Right. Like what was on people's desks or.
Yes. Yeah, because things would change through the course of the day.
Yeah, and if we were going backwards or.
Yeah,
shooting
like Office Olympics, you know, like right. Which games had been played. You know, you had to know at every moment. We tried to shoot in order usually.
Right.
But we had to know which games had been played to know what each part of the office looked like. It was a lot to, you know, I had to have like special charts for everything.
Like what else?
Well, for example, the clock was always in the shot and it didn't run. We'd set it. But when I prepped for each episode, I had to assign a time to each scene so that the set decorator could just take that list and set the clock. And they had. We realized after the first couple shows that we had to set it for every scene no matter what because you never knew what the camera was going to capture. I remember in the Hot Girl episode when they were buying purses,
yes.
You know, I had to keep track. That's another one. I had to keep track of what purse was on what desk at what time, like who bought what. And I remember very distinctly, this was the moment I realized that we had to be so careful about continuity. We had to make sure the whole office was correct for every scene because we were shooting a close-up of Dwight. And I remember Randall just suddenly went around to the other side of Dwight so you could see Katie in the background, Amy Adams,
mm-hmm.
You know, and you could suddenly see that he had the purse that he bought later on his desk.
Right.
And so, of course, I had to run in. No, that's not there yet. But that's when I realized, no, we can't leave anything out. You know, everything has to be correct for every moment.
Right.
Because I don't know what the cameras are going to see.
Yes. I remember you with the clock and with the watches on people's wrists. Yeah. And I said later, and I have used this since, that the greatest decision that I ever unwittingly made was that
not
Kevin did not wear a watch.
Thank God. Because
having to adjust that watch every scene and the clock, you're right.
Well, the watches, I got a little more easygoing about the watches. I decided only if someone like was going to be really showing it to the camera. Because that, there was enough for us to worry about. There was so much.
Right. Who does the script supervisor serve?
Well, the script supervisor is a department of one. So you're your own boss.
Yes.
And it's really hard to manage them. I remember there was a Kelly line about how she was a department of one and her department was so hard to manage. I always thought that applied to script supervisors.
Right. But in terms of, I guess, I don't know, it's so interesting to me. Like in terms of, you know, you're talking about needing to do stuff for the editors. You've got writers chirping at you, telling you, you know, that they want lines set a certain way.
You serve them all.
You, okay.
Production, you keep track of a lot of information about the scripts and, you know, how much is shot and how much remains. You keep track of all the scenes and, you know, if anything's missing, you tell them right away. Or you keep track of scenes and what the director or the writers want to include in the cut for the editor.
Mm-hmm.
And for the actors, you're helping them with lines. Sometimes they don't treat it as help, but you basically are helping them remember their lines, and you work for the writers in the sense that you're trying to make sure the script is properly shot and that all the lines are as written,
right?
Especially on The Office, because, I mean, let's face it, it was like Shakespeare. The lines were beautiful.
Yeah.
They had to be said exactly as written at least once or twice just because they were so beautifully written. It just had to be that way. So I was a real stickler for the verbiage, you know, the
right.
People would cower when I came towards them. If they had like a whole paragraph that they had to say, they would be so nervous that I was going to tell them they were doing it all wrong. But, you know, for the most part, I just wanted the comedy to be as funny as it possibly could be.
Right. I want to talk about that a little bit, that relationship between the actors and you on the show. Like, did you feel comfortable with everybody? Well, like Rain, for example, like Rain would give you hell.
I loved him. You know, I loved everybody. It was, everybody had a different way. You know, I think a lot of actors just, they want it to be so perfect that they get frustrated. And sometimes they take it out on me a little bit, but I don't really take it personally. And I know there's a lot of pressure on them.
You were very, very skilled at that. Particularly when we were in the conference room. And I just recall at times, you know, being in between a take and there being a kind of pause that when you're inside the conference room, you weren't quite sure what was happening. Like it felt like nothing was happening. And then you would turn the corner and it would be like, uh-oh, somebody's getting it now. Somebody is getting it from Veda. But I think it was all truly, it felt like everybody was working to try to make it the best show.
Oh, absolutely. That was so lovely and unusual about that show. Like, I mean, for 9 years, I was excited to go to work. I got up, I was happy that I was going to see the scenes I was going to see that day. And I was so excited to see everybody at work, you know, every day. So, and I think everyone felt that way. We all loved it so much. We wanted it to be as good as possible. So sometimes it took, you know, a little bit of bullying, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
To get some, sometimes people would argue with me about lines. Well, I would make them say like every article, every little word, because I could feel the rhythm of the line. Like I knew how the line was supposed to sound. It was in my head. So I just ignored when people thought I was crazy because I knew I was right. And it quite often the line would get a laugh after they added that tiny little word like a, just like one little word could make all the difference.
Right.
That show. I've never seen that in any other show.
How much after you handed in your notes, were you in dialogue with Dave Rogers or Claire or Dean or not really? Like once, because you were shooting the next episode.
I absolutely was because okay. They were right there. They were in the next building, which is such a luxury because that doesn't happen very often. So I could go over there at lunchtime or between scenes and say, you know, here's what's happening. A lot of times I would have to talk to them about the director because we had a different director for each episode almost, you know.
Right.
And so many newcomers who were experienced directors, but they had never worked on the show before. So sometimes I thought they weren't quite getting it right. So I'd go and talk to Dave. You know, what do you think about what we shot yesterday? Is this director getting it? Is there any way that I could kind of nudge them in one direction or another? And sometimes he'd say, you know, just get more reaction shots, get tons of reactions for this episode because I'm going to really need them. Or they'd say, you know, this director's not getting enough angles. I need more angles to be able to pace the scene the way I need to pace it. Because that was a big thing for them, pacing for the comedy.
Right. I remember some instances, but I want to talk to you about how you were tracking not just continuity within an episode, but also continuity within relationships that spanned arcs, right?
Yes, I was. And sometimes that was very difficult. Well, first of all, I didn't always know what or remember like what parts of the script had ended up in the final cut because it was half of it basically would be in the final cut. So I didn't always remember what had actually aired. And then if something was stated in season two and then in season five, we revisited that idea, sometimes I wouldn't remember that we'd already said something about that. And I'll give you an example, like who started at Dunder Mifflin first, Pam or Jim?
Okay.
That was a big issue that the fans noticed because early on we said it was Pam, I believe, and then later on, we said Jim had been there, or I don't remember which way around it was, but it was years, literally years later that we addressed it again and contradicted ourselves. And that was, you know, I would catch those things quite often, but I couldn't catch all of them. It was just too hard.
Right.
So
there were 22 characters.
And they all had their own stories.
With different relationships to different people.
There was some question about, like, how many kids did Meredith actually have? Was it one or two? Because she says, when she's being described to Michael, when he's trying to write a funny message on her birthday card in the first season,
yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah, yeah.
They say she has two kids. And then later she only had one. So then I think it was in a webisode that we addressed that issue and why she wouldn't talk about the other kid.
Right. And I think that was the other thing I remember Greg talking about, which was, the webisodes. Was that a part of the history of the show too? Or was it just the episodes? Or was it everything we shot?
There's a lot to keep track of.
Yeah.
And the writers had to try to keep it all in their heads too, you know. So hopefully with everybody thinking about it, most of the problems got addressed. But I'm sure there are things that the fans are still finding.
Right.
Little nuggets. So
you would take the script and you would break it. So tell me like the process of how you would break down a script.
Well, I would do that on the weekends. I would take the script and for each scene, I would, you know, note for myself the significant things that happened for each character in each scene. And then what time of day that was. So that I would be able to create like a story flow for myself. After the first season, I believe there was almost always a B story as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I would separate out the A, the B. Sometimes there was a C story, and I'd color code them so that I'd see each story separately and how it developed over the course of the day.
So, like you're tracking, say, if Michael and Carol have something this episode, and Jim and Pam, or, you know, Daryl and Jim, or something, right? You're tracking all three of those.
like in the middle of the day, they're not speaking to each other, you know, then I know that, you know, okay, that's about 4 hours into the day. And then a couple hours later, something happens that makes them bond again. And yeah, that I was definitely tracking that kind of thing. And I would get a lot of questions about that from the actors.
Yes. Like, when is this happening?
Yeah.
We're shooting scenes out of order.
Yeah.
When
did I get angry?
Yes. Right.
Am I building up to it now, or has it already happened? Yeah.
Right. So you have this chart, and I'm fascinated about this. So are you, once actors get in wardrobe, if the wardrobe is changing, does that get added to your chart?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every department keeps their own continuity, so I'm just really checking it.
Right. The Yankee Swap episode must be the most complicated and difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when does Phyllis have the mitt?
Yeah.
She gives it to Michael. And when we're shooting scenes out of order, who has it? What are they doing with it?
Yeah, definitely had to have a very clear chart of that. I remember Mike Schur and I were in the green room for that, because that was when we still were not allowed on set. And I remember we had so many charts on the walls. And one of the charts was his tally of how many times he had to run in each day. I still have that document.
Oh my gosh, you do?
I kept that document.
Oh my God. Like, how many times he had to run in? That is really funny. On an episode-by-episode basis, you're a department of one. So you serve yourself, and you're served by yourself. But are you, like, who are you working closest with on a week? Is it the writers? Is it the director?
It's usually the director.
Okay.
But, I mean, the director and the actors. But on The Office, the writer was very involved. So I also worked very closely with the writers. That isn't always the case. On comedies, usually the writer comes to set, but quite often they'll send a writer to supervise the writing for them. You know, there will be like a designated writer who's on set. But on The Office, it was usually the writer of the episode would be on set.
Did you have any special secrets or ways that you dealt with any of the particular actors on set? I mean, your relationship with each actor is different.
Well, there were different ways I would have to phrase things. Like, would you try one where you say it this way? Or, you know, with you, I would just say, you know, here's the line in the script.
Right.
Like, you know, there wasn't a lot of attitude there. So
right.
You would just say,
mostly,
you would
yes.
just say, okay, but I want to say it this way. You know, we would just negotiate and it would be quick,
right.
quick and easy.
Yes, there would be some negotiation. Yes, okay.
But sometimes I would have to word things carefully because I remember once I told one of the actors, it's funnier this way. And I realized, no, I can't say it that way because he got so mad at me. Don't tell me what's funny.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is that I imagine on some shows there would be a level of defensiveness or like, I don't feel like we had that. I feel like everybody was trying very hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody wanted it to be funny and I felt like there was an understanding. They knew that I was saying something because I thought it would improve their line or improve the scene.
Yes.
It wasn't ever personal for me. So I think for the most part, people were really nice to me.
I think it was more, I just remember fondly, actually. I don't know if you felt that way, but I remember just a very, you know, almost like family. Like when you would turn the corner, it would be like, oh no, here's Veda. Yeah. Oh boy.
No, it was fun. It was frustrating to me that I couldn't prompt lines because I just was usually too far away.
Right.
My voice doesn't carry very well and people would end up just laughing when they asked for a line because they couldn't hear it.
That's exactly right.
That was so frustrating for me. I mean, I like prompting lines. I try to do it in a timely fashion. But I don't know if you remember, after a while, we asked the stand-ins, Stephen Socks and Rory Socks, to be on lines if it was a long scene.
They would kind of crouch somewhere closer and just be...
That came from me because I said, you know, it's really not... On this show, I really can't be on the lines all the time. So we set up that system where Lori and Stephen would sit in the room and just give lines really quickly. Because that's what you need when you're an actor, right? You need to hear the line just really quickly so you can stick with the momentum of the scene.
Right.
So you don't lose the scene.
I do remember, though, just, again, I don't know why all my memories go back to the conference room, but just being in the conference room and someone going, what is it? What's the line? And you hear, and then everyone just laughing because there was just no.
I was so embarrassed.
There was no way to hear. How difficult was it to track all of the improv stuff that happened?
Well, I couldn't really track it. I mean, I would just say, okay, here, this is a big chunk of improv. And I try to describe to the editor what was happening in that section. And I try to make sure there were points where they could cut in and out of the improv sections. And that was all I could really do. Just make sure that everything up to the improv matched and everything coming out of it matched.
Right.
And that there were angles to cut to in case they needed to cut out of it. So I'd always encourage that we got reaction shots. That was a big deal, to get a reaction pass.
Yeah, which would give just cutaway points through anything.
Cut to Kevin.
Cut to Kevin, yes. In terms of unscripted stuff or even physical gestures, I'm sure that you had an instinct, at least eventually, like, oh, well, that's going to be in the show. The example that I'm thinking about is Gay Witch Hunt. So Oscar or Michael going and kissing Oscar.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So I knew that would be in the show. Yes.
Yeah. How do you signal that out, or does that become a specific thing that you add in to the script for the editor? Or?
Yes. My script is always the official script. It represents what was shot. So I cross out things that we don't shoot, and I'll add things that we do shoot if they're not in the script. So definitely I'll write that in. So I put, you know, this in this take, Michael kisses Oscar. Every, you know, director and the writer love that. Use it if you can, you know.
Okay. Oh, those
things. That. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, I did after a while know which takes were going to be in the show, which takes were going to be looked at the most closely. And, you know, I knew what Dave would choose. When I saw the show, you know, at the end of the week, I would recognize the takes that he chose. I think I knew he was going to pick that one.
Yeah.
After a while, like it's the family thing. I mean, you just know people's taste, you know how they work, you know each other so well after a while.
Yeah. I mean, Greg, obviously you're working closely with him when he's writing on set, when he's directing. How much communication do you have with him about your job specifically?
It was just when he was on set, really, when he was directing particularly. And he would interact with me a lot. And then I think that's when people find out what my job is, when they direct something.
Right. Were there any particular relationships with directors that you felt like you worked really well with and that working relationship matured as the show went on?
Well, I think, always when the writer directed their own episode, there was a real understanding because I always really appreciated the scripts. The scripts were so good. You know, and I think that they felt there was a lot of support coming from me because I wanted the script shot properly. And sometimes I could help a little bit with the angles and the, you know, the way the scene was shot because I knew what we would traditionally do with a scene like that, you know. So I always enjoyed working with Ken Kwapis and Paul Feig and Ken Whittingham, and yeah, there were certain directors that would keep coming back and that I would love to work with. it was funny on The Office, particularly on that show. After a few years, we felt like we knew how to make the show. And we felt like we didn't even need a director.
Right.
So the director would come on and they would be guided by all of us. And sometimes we would wonder about how they were shooting something. I remember one time a scene was shot. It was a scene in the parking lot. We were shooting it from an angle that I thought wasn't that right angle for the show, but that was just from what was in my head when I read it.
Right.
Well, the next week we came back and reshot it from the other angle. And I hadn't said anything.
Right.
Because I felt like it wasn't really my place. I mean, the director and the DP were decided to shoot it from the other side, but I thought that's not how this is supposed to be shot. So sometimes, you know, there was a real feeling that the crew knew the set, knew the characters, knew the scripts better than anyone else. And so the director would just bring in a few interesting ideas that would shake it up a little, which was good.
Right.
Because it never became formulaic for that reason, I think, because we had so many new directors all the time.
Yeah. Well, here's some names. Randall Einhorn, Matt Sohn, John Krasinski, me, I believe Steve Carell, Claire Scanlon, Dave Rogers, all directed, I'm sure I'm missing some, but all directed on The Office for the first time. How was that for you working with inexperienced people, but people who knew the show so well? Did that present specific challenges?
Yes and no. I mean, when we had a famous director coming in, it was always exciting, but it was always, that was more of a challenge because they didn't always get the show and it was hard to politely steer them in the right direction. When it was somebody who was working on the show already, that problem was already solved. They got the show. They knew what the humor, they knew the humor, they knew the characters, they knew the spaces that we generally worked in, and they knew how to make the show. But sometimes they didn't know how to direct.
Right.
Just because they hadn't done it before.
Right.
And sometimes they didn't realize all the different things that were their responsibilities. And because we all knew how to make the show, we would often pick up the slack and we would do right. part of the director's job. And that was sometimes difficult because we all had so much to do already to have to, you know, help someone out when they don't even realize you're helping them out. That was kind of hard sometimes.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, you had all people just trying to direct this show, but the diverse range of experiences. You know, you've got editors, you've got Dave Rogers and Claire Scanlon, mm-hmm. who presumably have never dealt with actors before.
Right, yeah, right. But they knew what shots they needed.
They knew what shots they needed. And then you've got Randall and Matt, mm-hmm. who, again, don't really know how to deal with actors,
but
they know
part of the job.
They know where that camera is, yeah. whereas, you know, actors, I knew how I wanted it to look, but don't talk to me about lenses, right? Or like right. what lens we're going to use, you know? So it's like coming at it from just different yeah. perspectives. I just think it's very interesting.
I mean, every director has their strengths and weaknesses, but when you'd get someone like Ken Kwapis, you know, it would go really smoothly because not only did he understand the show and know how to make the show, but he also knew all the aspects of directing and what everyone was expecting from him. So that was always the best for me when it was somebody like that. But I know I really, you know, wanted to support everybody. So, you know, everybody who directed, I felt like they were bringing a lot of new things to the table and some things they just weren't that aware of yet. But, you know, like some directors would, you know, like an actor directing would be very aware of the acting, would be very often very aware of what would make the scene funny, which was great. But they might not be aware of the angles and the different kinds of coverage that we needed and the lighting or something, you know, so they wouldn't work with those departments. Mm. So those departments would have to jump in and pick up the slack.
Right. Michael's search for family, you know, ends up being his, you know, his major journey through mm-hmm. the show.
Yeah.
Do you have any specific recollections or memories about that, about a man who had nobody, all he wanted was somebody. He used the office as that somebody, and then mm-hmm. eventually finding love and going away.
Well, it was what kept me hooked on his character the whole time. I was always so interested to see what Steve would do with each new situation. What I kept wanting to find out, what I was so fascinated with every day, was to see how the scenes would play out. Because when I read the script and studied it over the weekend, I always had very specific ideas about how it would look. I mean, I could see the whole episode in my head. So I guess what, you know, it's just like a personal fascination with, you know, is that the way it's going to look, or is there going to be something different about it that I haven't imagined yet? And it was just fascinating.
Yeah.
To see how the actors would play out the scenes and how they'd say the lines, because I would love the lines and I would want to hear them. And I could hear, like, I could hear your voice in my head. I could hear, you know, Michael's voice, Jim's voice. You know, I knew how they generally delivered their lines, but I always wanted to hear how these specific lines were going to sound. So as far as, you know, the character arc and the journey, I always felt like I was just an observer in that. You know, and the writers were always coming up with interesting new twists.
Right. Here's a question I've been asking people. What were you afraid of missing more, Steve or Michael Scott?
Oh. Well, I was afraid that without Michael Scott, the show wouldn't work. And it did work. So I was proud of us that we managed to make it work. But I knew personally that I would miss Steve terribly, that my heart would ache, that I wouldn't just miss seeing him. And it's hard for a crew, you know, when you get close to actors, because you can't just go over to their house, you know, you can't just call them up and say you want to have a drink, you know, because it's a different kind of relationship. It's a work relationship. So, you know, I knew I would miss him.
Yeah.
As a person, you know, just miss seeing him.
Well, and you, this is sort of occurring to me, but, you know, for 7 years, he had the most to say. So you definitely had the bulk of your work with him.
Mm. He had long speeches too.
Yes.
Which he could memorize so fast. That always amazed me. But I would help him.
Yeah.
He would always warn me, you know, I'm going to be all over the place with this, you know, so I would just tell him if I thought something wasn't working or if he was leaving something out or, you know, he needed to say something a little differently. But for the most part, I just let him do his thing.
Was he always receptive to you?
Well, he was so sweet. You know, he was always receptive because he knew I had a concern. You know, it wasn't just, I wasn't just trying to wield my power or something. You know, I actually, it was genuine. He knew that. So we do have a picture we took, though. We posed where Steve is going like this, kind of like wants to push me away, and I'm trying to give him a line. Because that's the general
right.
feeling when the script supervisor gives lines, that, you know, they're nagging you.
Did you ever feel like Toby? Did you ever feel like Toby?
Always. Pretty much always. Well, I don't know, because my, you know, this was a second career for me. I was an academic first, and I was a professor and
art history, right?
Mm-hmm, and you know, film stuff, film history, film studies, and so my approach was always very sort of academic. You know, this line is, you know, and I think I might nitpick a little because I don't always have the perspective on it. You know, maybe this isn't that important, but you know, I try to. Every script supervisor tries to judge very clearly in their mind, you know, is this important enough for me to interrupt things, for me to throw, you know, you don't want to throw the actors off. You don't want to give them stuff to think about. You want them to do their thing. But, I mean, as far as continuity goes or lines or any of that, it's never perfect. There's always something you can correct, but you have to try to be smart about what to correct and what to just leave, because you don't want people to feel like they have to pay attention to the lines. You want them to pay attention to the acting, or they're, you don't want them to suddenly start paying attention to like where their arms are, or where, you know. So I really try to correct people to a minimum. I try to keep it to a minimum, because in my job there is a certain nerdiness. You know, you tend to be very attuned to details, and you don't always see the big picture. So, you know, I try to pay attention to the directors and to, you know, how they're dealing with the actors. If they're not giving notes, I'm not going to go in and give a note, because there's a reason they're not giving them yet. They're trying to let the actor find something. And I, over the years, I think I've gotten more and more sensitive to that.
What was it like working with Steve as a director? The last episode he directed is the one he proposes to Holly. What was it like working with him
so
in that way?
He's so smart, you know, and it made it pretty easy because he was so nice, so smart, so savvy about the show. He was a great director to have.
Yeah. Toward the end, he had this idea that he wanted Threat Level Midnight to be seen on the show. Talk to me a little bit about the challenge of attempting to piece together and find the continuity of this movie that was supposedly shot.
Well, the thing about that was that it was supposed to be goofy. We weren't doing continuity for Threat Level Midnight. It was going to be something that didn't have continuity. But that's a tricky thing, because I remember when I first got hired to do the show, I remember Ken Quapis saying, we're not going to worry about continuity because it's a documentary. The documentarians can make mistakes. But that only works on certain levels. That works on the level of, on the cutting level. Like if the documentarians cut in two different pieces of a take, cut them together in an awkward way, that would be okay. But you can't cut together two takes that don't match, because then you're implying that this thing happened twice and it only happened once. You know what I mean? So
right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no.
So there has to be a reality to it, that, you know, so that continuity was actually very important in the end and not something I could ignore. And you didn't want to imply that the documentarians were saying, okay, do this again.
Right.
And, you know, but do it a little differently, because they were just supposed to be shooting discreetly, you know, and not controlling what was happening. There were all kinds of new kinds of continuity that I hadn't really thought about before. Like if somebody was out of the office, their jacket couldn't be on their chair because they were wearing it.
Right.
So you'd have to, you know, look at sort of the opposite side of the continuity, what shouldn't be there.
Oh, right.
In the parking lot, it was the same way. What cars should be there and what cars shouldn't be there. We'd have to always think about that.
Well, the most important car was your actual car.
Yes.
Right?
That was Kevin's car.
Kevin's car for a long time. Do you remember when it first got established?
It was right away. It was like,
yeah.
Yeah, the first season.
Yeah.
And
as just going to the car.
You drove it a few times.
I drove it quite a few times in the end. Yes, in front of Holly when she's impressed with me, sort of most notably. Yeah, I remember thinking, you know, she's so impressed that I'm driving the car. And I remember having this idea of just driving it straight over the curb, just like bye-bye, and just plowing right. And then I thought, well,
it's
Veda's
car.
I think I won't do that. Yeah, but I always remember RAV4.
Oh, it wasn't a RAV4. It was a CR-V.
CR-V.
Yeah,
CR-V.
At first I forgot myself. Yes. But no, it was a Honda CR-V.
Honda CR-V.
And do you remember there was like this fuzzy tiger-striped cover over the wheel?
Over the wheel, yes.
After a couple of years, my husband bought that for me because the steering wheel would get cold.
Yeah.
But I remember at the production meeting, John was directing the episode where you were driving the car. And I asked him, I said, should I take off the fuzzy steering wheel cover? And he said, I would never ask you to do that. I would never ask you to take off something like that. No, if that's on your car, you leave that.
That's so great.
And we all got a little bump on our paycheck I think it was like $5 that you got if your car was in a scene. And they just kept a tally of how many times your car was in a scene, and you'd get a little bump for that.
Really? Do you get residuals? Does the car get residuals? No.
No, but the car was in a lot of shots.
A lot of shots. No, it was. Was The Office your acting debut?
Well, I was only in that last, I was in that last episode, and yes.
That was your acting
absolutely,
debut?
Absolutely, yes.
Any memories about being on set in front of the camera?
I was always so nervous. I'm really shy, so that was not comfortable for me, but I like that we were all, that a lot of us were in that final episode. I
Nelson
think
Jones.
Very cool.
Yeah.
But yeah. It was, I didn't want to have a line or anything.
What do you remember going into the finale? Did you feel like it was time for it to be over?
I didn't want it to be over personally.
Right.
I would have liked to just work on that show for the rest of my career. But I felt like it was smart to decide when your show is going to end and wrap it up beautifully instead of just ending it suddenly. But it was so sad. It was just hard. For all of us, I think.
Yeah. What was it, do you think, about the show that, I mean, obviously it's a job, and in our industry, like having a job and a good job is a blessing, but it felt different. There was something about it that felt special.
Yes, definitely. There was a lot of love, there was a lot of caring for the show, caring for each other. It was a good environment. And, even though it was very tiring, we were all exhausted. It felt good to do that job and to be there every day. It was hard to imagine not having that. And I really never have found a show where I feel that way. So I was right to be sad because it really was something that I was losing. I mean, I've enjoyed shows I've worked on since then, but I never felt that warmth and that camaraderie in anything else. We all laughed so much that sometimes it was hard to finish a scene. And I had to put that in my notes because, I'd say this scene was great up until they all broke. That was something the editors would mention to me sometimes. I can't cut this. It's like somebody's breaking in every take. But then also the crew, we had to, we couldn't laugh out loud. And that is hard to do sometimes, especially if you're in that little talking head room.
Yeah.
And you're sitting right in front of the actor. There were times when I had to actually leave the room. But that was one thing that made it great to be there every day because there was so much that was so funny. There was so much laughter.
Talk to me about this German lullaby that appeared in the show.
That was in something Mindy wrote, right?
Mindy Kaling. The episode was Night Out.
It was Dwight.
Dwight sings Ryan to sleep.
Yeah. My mother was Viennese.
Okay.
So her first language was German. And when growing up in Vienna, they spoke German. And so her mother would sing her German lullabies. So when I was a child, she sang German lullabies to me when I was falling asleep. So I knew a couple of German lullabies. And so I just piped up and said, you know, because I guess she wanted him to sing something to Ryan.
Yes.
Yeah. So I said, well, he could sing what my mother sang to me, and I sang it for her. Was it Schlaf, Kindlein, Schlaf? I'm not sure. Schlaf, Kindlein, Schlaf. Mm-hmm.
Is that the one? Yeah,
something
I think that was
like
it.
That. Yeah. And I always found it very soothing. So, so yeah, it turned
out. How did it go?
Well, I don't remember the words right now, but I know it goes, starts Schlaf, Kindlein, Schlaf. I don't remember the words.
Yeah,
right,
that's
now.
All right.
And I remembered the words, or I looked them up.
Schlaf, Kindlein, Schlaf. That's very funny. Guys, is there anything else that I've missed here?
Is there anything on my
list? Yeah, look at your list.
I actually hit all this stuff. Do you ever say that's what she said?
I say it. I say it around friends. I tend to not draw attention to that fact. But yes. Do you say that's what she said?
Well, my husband and I say it all the time at home.
Yeah.
But I try not to say it on set anymore because I think people do get maybe offended by it. And, you know, sets are so sensitive now about harassment and saying things like that. So I don't say it on set anymore. Sometimes I have to say it, so I say it to myself really
right.
quietly.
Do you think that this show could be made now in this?
Oh, that's a good question.
Woke PC environment.
I think it was, you know, a perfect storm. It's like, you know, everything came together at that moment. All the people involved. All the ideas, all the, the crew, the talent, it all came together in a way that made it all work. And I don't know if it could ever happen exactly that way again.
Yeah.
I don't know if it has to do with the time period or it was just the miracle of all those personalities coming together at that moment.
Yeah. Veda, thank you so much
for
coming. Yeah, for coming to talk to me and your perspective, having watched it all as it happened, is really
great. Well, it was
really
a delight
great.
To watch.
Well, Veda, what a delight you are. And thank you for speaking with me. What a true pleasure to have you in. That's what she said. And thank you, listeners, for joining in. Join us again next week, please, for another riveting conversation. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us comments on whatever podcast platform you see fit. Have a great week. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Tessa Kramer. Our producers are Emily Carr and Diego Tapia. Our social media producer is Liz Hayes. My main man in the booth is Alec Moore. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend, Creed Bratton. And the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.